dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. As unwelcome guests, I'm Lynn Gary. From food shortages to energy scarcity, from climate change to economic implosion, we're beset with a host of situations where crisis can be turned to opportunity. All of these problems we face result from an economic and political system based on the compulsive overproduction and consumption of junk and waste in the service of an abstraction, economic growth. This state of affairs need not, and by some accounts, cannot continue. Our two featured speakers this week will look at where we are and why, and where we might go by focusing on two areas. Raj Patel will talk about the food system, and Richard Heinberg will unveil his idea to create crisis planning for what he calls resilient communities. We have to make our plans that serve our interests, because the powers that be are busy making plans for us that are totally unacceptable. Detention camps being built by Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Crowd control weapons being developed. And laws being passed that make us and keep us slaves, turning our communities into sacrifice zones. We heard something about this in last week's program on the effects of gas drilling. This show has covered on an ongoing basis the democracy revolution of making local laws to challenge corporate power that is taking place in rural Pennsylvania and spreading outward. That this movement should have originated in Pennsylvania is not surprising, given that state's long history as a corporate sacrifice zone. First for oil, coal, industrial pollution, and now gas drilling and waste disposal. Before we hear our main speakers, a report on new developments in that effort. This news comes from CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Pennsylvania's Attorney General is suing a local municipality on behalf of corporations who've been banned from dumping sewage sludge in those communities. Municipal governments across Pennsylvania are voting their support for the right of a small Schuylkill County township to protect its citizens against corporations dumping sludge in violation of their local law. On December 6, 2006, the Board of Supervisors in East Brunswick Township upheld their oaths to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the community by enacting an ordinance that prohibits corporate sludge dumping. Their vote came after months of petitioning and organizing by residents who argued that Pennsylvanians retain the right to make local self-governing decisions for the protection of their communities and that those rights cannot be preempted by the state. With reports continuing to come in, so far 23 local governments have reported passing resolutions in support of East Brunswick and in opposition to State Attorney General Thomas Corbett's lawsuit, in which he has asked the Commonwealth Court to strip the community of its local law. Five other communities and three organizations have signed on as legal allies of East Brunswick, filing friend-of-the-court briefs and asking the Commonwealth Court to leave the ordinance intact. Those allies include Tamaqua Borough in Schuylkill County, Donegal Township in Washington County, Blaine Township in Washington County, the town of Barnstead in New Hampshire, the town of Halifax in Virginia, the Pennsylvania Farmers Union, the Pennsylvania Family Farm Coalition, and Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, California. In a legal brief filed with the court against East Brunswick on January 31, 2008, the Attorney General's office had this to say, quote, "There is no inherent right to local self-government," close quote. Municipal officials and Pennsylvanians from a growing list of communities have made a point to publicly and officially disagree. On June 27th, Stephen C. Brown, township manager for London Grove Township in Chester County, Pennsylvania, wrote on behalf of that municipality, quote, "The board voted 5-0 to support East Brunswick Township in your drive to support the right of townships to local self-government. The London Grove supervisors believe this basic issue of self-determination is of the utmost importance to our community and to communities throughout the Commonwealth," close quote. Conewango Township in Warren County passed their resolution on the 9th of June, explaining their, quote, "full support of East Brunswick Township Board of Supervisors and its residents in their efforts to defend their sewage sludge ordinance against the suit filed by the Office of the Attorney General," saying in part that, quote, "representatives of agribusiness and waste disposal corporations succeeded after years of efforts opposed by communities and local governments in driving anti-democratic legislation through the Pennsylvania General Assembly to strip municipalities of self-governing authority over issues that directly affect local citizens," close quote. On June 5th, York County's Hopewell Township joined others in prefacing their support for East Brunswick's stand with provisions like these, quote, "Whereas just government is ever at the consent of the governed, and the people of East Brunswick have taken a clear stand in enacting said ordinance, indicating that they do not consent to the disposal of sewage sludge in their community. And whereas a denial of local self-governing authority by the state on behalf of corporations that will especially benefit from such usurpation is unjust, illegitimate, and beyond the authority of the state or any government," close quote. Borough Manager Chris L. Bohm of Macungie wrote on June 13th, "We agree that the people who reside in the community and are directly affected by decisions must be the ones to make them." Dozens of communities have passed similar resolutions in support of local self-government. And since the Attorney General filed his lawsuit against East Brunswick, these are some of the municipalities that have adopted ordinances to prohibit and make impractical the surface dumping of sewage sludge: Mahanoy Township in Schuylkill County, Packer Township in Carbon County, Branch Township in Schuylkill County. Other communities are actively considering the adoption of similar ordinances, including Shrewsbury Township in York County, which has voted to advertise a public hearing to consider adoption with a vote likely in September. The town of Hector, New York, has also held community meetings and authorized the Citizens for Agricultural and Rural Responsibility, a community group of Hector residents, to explore language for a local ordinance banning sludge spreading. For more information, go to carrcny.org. Next, an interview with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved. He was interviewed at the Los Angeles Book Expo for Book TV by Evan Kleiman, host of the radio program Good Food, heard on KCRW in Los Angeles.
And I am really happy today to get to introduce you to a fantastic author, Raj Patel, whose book is Stuffed and Starved. Raj comes to the issues of food politics in a seemingly natural way. He was educated at Oxford and many other fabulous places on food policy. Yeah, the opportunity to actually experience working on the ground within large banking and other structural organizations like the World Bank, the WTO, and the UN. And then he also spent some time working in food justice organizations such as Food First and some land-based reform organizations, all of which pretty much positions him at a time and place right now to take a look at our food system. What are the benefits and where? Why are we where we are now with it? So I'm so happy to have you here with me.
It's great to be here, Em.
So a lot of times I think about this food crisis that we hear about so much right now in the news. And obviously it didn't spring whole cloth from the ether. It comes out of a food system that has been sort of pushing the edges for a long time now. I'd be really interested in this first half hour that we have together if we could explore a little bit the current food system, some of its roots, how did we get here from there, and let's take it also farm to fork, because it really seems that in the world of food politics, it really does span that very important place just from food to fork.
Well, you're right, and it does seem, if one's following the media, as if this has come out of nowhere, but you're right, it hasn't. In a good year, in 2006, before the food crisis happened, there were 850 million people who were food insecure at some point during that year. And that is clearly a figure that's much higher now, now that the food prices have gone so very high, and at the same time as incomes are starting to decline for the poorest people. So there is a longer background. One of the things I try and do in Stuffed and Starved is show just how long the run-up has been.
It's really extraordinary how you go back historically. When we think about food, it seems like there has to be something structural in this system to make a decision to allow that many people to be hungry.
Well, you're right. And what's interesting is that system is pretty new. In the book, I look at India. India is a very interesting sort of proving ground for the mechanisms that we see amplified around the world today. Before the British arrived in India, India was largely a feudal society, and that meant that serfs produced for the landlord. The landlord extracted that surplus and basically could do with it what he liked. The only upside for the serfs being that in years of famine, it was the landlord's responsibility to feed them. It was the only silver lining in a very dark cloud. But when the British arrived, they thought this was pathetically backward, that what India needed was capitalism, and what it needed was markets. The idea of waiting for a handout was scorned as a sort of reactionary, sort of backward thing. And what the British did was to shift India towards producing grain for the market. Now that worked great for Britain because they were able to access the Indian wheat market, and the wheat was shipped from Bombay to Liverpool, where it fed the English working class. Didn't work out so well for the Indians, and there are stories of Indians carrying bags of grain, loading them onto British ships. The ships would sail, and the grain loaders would die of hunger at the docks.
How does this happen?
Well, it happens because in moving from a feudal system to a capitalist system, the moral economy, if you like, is cut away. In other words, the duties of care, the responsibilities that a society has towards its poorest people are eviscerated. And there isn't a figure that displays this more poignantly, I think, than this one. But in the 2,000 years before the British came to India, there was a famine once every 120 years. But in the 150 years or so after the British came, there was a famine once every 4 years. So from 120 years to 4 years per famine. And that was because when you introduce the market in food, you introduce some fairly basic rules, which is if you've got money, you can have the food, and if you are too poor to be able to afford it, you starve. We're kind of seeing that today. We're seeing that dynamic in place today. So, for example, if we're interested in why 35.5 million Americans in 2006 went hungry. We need to look at poverty. We need to look at the ability or inability of Americans to be able to afford food. It's not a question about supply. It's not a question about the availability of food.
No, it's a question about will.
And distribution, exactly.
Now, you talk a lot about distribution in your book, Stuffed and Starved, and you have this marvelous graphic that makes it very, very clear. Could you discuss that chart where it's pinched at the center of the hourglass?
Sure. What I have in the book is this sort of hourglass figure that kind of looks like that. And I find it a useful way to explain how we consumers are connected to the people who grow our food. Because there are hundreds of millions of people involved in agriculture across the planet. There are more than 6 billion of us consuming that food. But in the middle, there's just a handful of very powerful corporations that control the truck and barter of food that goes from field to fork. In every major food commodity, that number of corporations is 4 or 5, controlling more than half the market. In tea, there's one company, Unilever, that controls 90% of the world market. So you have these sort of oligopolies that are absolutely at the middle of this sort of food system hourglass. So you have millions at the top, billions at the bottom, and just a few in the middle.
And a system like this, it seems to be ripe for crisis. If you have such a small point of people who are actually distributing, making sure the food moves around and that it passes through them, and we might say those people are earning the most money of this whole system, what happens when they start to get pushed or when people try and go around them?
You're right. I mean, this hourglass system is very fragile, but it's fragile for these sort of bigger structural reasons. One of the examples I cover in the book is a story that comes from Britain, where in Britain, as now, there were, the beginning of the 2000s, a series of protests around fuel prices, and truckers blocked the refineries, and the number of road journeys was drastically reduced. Although it was never reported, Britain was within hours of running out of food on the shelves. Not because, again, of insufficiency of food, but because so much of our food consumption
Why
and distribution...
Why was it never reported?
Well, because it never happened. At the end of the day, the food was shipped. It's something that the British government woke up to, and it is something that was discussed by the Ministry of Defence, according to at least one of my informants. It's something that is not well known, absolutely, but it is something that shows just how very close to crisis our food system is. And that's just one example. I mean, we could look at mad cow disease, for example, which has already affected people in Britain. I have the misfortune of knowing 2 people who have been killed by mad cow disease.
Really?
It's an awful way to go. These were vibrant, dynamic, wonderful people, and within 6 months of knowing the disease, they were dead. And mad cow disease is entirely a product of our modern agricultural system. I mean, it comes from the industrial feeding of infected brain parts of cattle to cattle again. That decision was taken because it was efficient and it was a cheap way of feeding animals, a way of increasing profit. But the human cost has been very high. And if you think we've dodged the bullet on mad cow disease, think about bird flu, where most serious epidemiologists who've considered the issue are really rather worried about the possibility that the way we raise chickens in this industrial agricultural system is ripe for creating the breeding grounds for a variety of the bird flu virus that will jump species and have some fairly lethal effects.
So when we look at this distribution system, this kink in the system, and then you see alternative things that are happening, like the burgeoning farmers market movement, for example, here, and you see people trying to attempt to, through CSAs, community-supported agriculture, trying to forge a bond once again with local farmers, do you think that this sort of trying to remain local can actually succeed in the face of such concentration in the hands of those who distribute food?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, it's certainly the case that supermarkets have seen this shift towards local and are doing their very best to try and short-circuit it. I mean, you know, going local is a way of short-circuiting supermarkets, and they're trying to bring that back into the fold. So a supermarket near where I live in San Francisco now has an indoor farmer's market, and, you know, in which there is a simulacrum of public space and a, you know, sort of rustic straw-chewing farmers who are encouraging people to buy their wares, which are essentially the same foods that they were buying before, but now with a slightly different presentation. And in fact, supermarkets are just to sort of follow that train for a second, because supermarkets are geared towards bringing us into this industrial food system.
Now, let's talk about that for a little, because in the book you talk a lot about how we were created as consumers to a great degree by supermarkets, how they were designed, and how we learned to shop in them, because we didn't always shop in supermarkets.
Right. I mean, I found a picture of the patent for the first supermarket.
I mean, who knew that there was a patent for something that just seems so natural?
Well, this is it. I mean, this is how power works, the most outrageous, strange things become normalized over time. Again, in the book, the example I give of an outrageous thing is tea, where you have the ingredients for tea, which became a normal part of the British English working class diet. Well, I mean, it involved slavery in the sugar production from the Caribbean, and exploitation, colonialism in India and China, just to bring together the ingredients for something that is now considered very normal. But it required a great deal of violence. Now, when we're talking about supermarkets, it is a little odd that the first supermarket was patented, and it looked basically like a sort of rat maze, where consumers were taught to go in through one end, through a turnstile, and then made to go backwards and forwards in a sort of snaking path until they reached the checkout.
So they had to pass every single thing that was for sale.
That's right.
They could no longer come to a counter, like back in the day, and ask a clerk who knew where the food came from, knew everything about the food, and say, I'd like a pound of this, please, or a pound of that. Then it was driven by us.
Right. But again, we had to learn this. And in fact, one of the rules in the first supermarket was that clerks were not allowed to talk to the people who were asking for things. The idea is that if a clerk went and actually showed you where something was, that you wouldn't then be induced to browse everything else. It was an experiment, an early understanding of the idea that people will impulse purchase and they will buy much more when they are forced to look at everything and decide whether they want it or not, than if they come in with a list of things that they have rationally decided what to do.
Well, in these days, when we hear so much, like from Mary Nessel and other people who are dealing with serious food issues, who tell us for our health that we should be buying in the perimeter. Are there any studies now? Do more of us skip the inside of the market where what many of us like to think of as maybe the evil empire foods reside, the more processed?
I think it's a little early to say whether that's happening. I mean, I'm sure the supermarkets are on top of this. I mean, I talk about Walmart. It has the world's second largest computer after the Pentagon. It's a little disturbing, but I'm sure that they know right now whether people are sticking to the perimeter or not. But, I mean, in general, I mean, supermarkets are geared to get us to go in the middle. I mean, the most obvious example is milk. Why is milk always at the back in supermarkets?
Because everybody needs milk.
And that's, you know, so there's this golden triangle between the entrance and the milk and the checkout, where corporations bid to have their products at eye level or at cart level if they're aiming to go for our kids. And all along this route from entrance to milk to checkout. While I think it's a good idea to eat fresh fruits and vegetables, even just stepping into a supermarket is to surrender to some extent one's rational faculty. I mean, the golden triangle is one way of doing it. But even the smell in the air at supermarkets. I mean, the reason that there are bakeries in supermarkets is because it has been found that the smell of baking bread makes us buy more things. So even if we are shopping around the perimeter, we're still subject to these kinds of manipulative technologies that are designed to make us buy more than we would. And, you know, it's everything from the smell in the air to the music. I mean, there's a lot of money spent on the acoustics in supermarkets again.
One thing that I've always wondered is this idea of, if the supermarket is a place where all of us ultimately end up a consumer at the whim of the supermarket owner, why are supermarkets so reluctant to place markets in areas where there are lower socioeconomic folks living?
I think that, I mean, there is the sort of, there are food deserts. That's a sort of technical term that's used to describe areas of cities, but also in rural areas, where there are people on low incomes who find it very hard to find fresh fruits and vegetables.
I mean, I find it astounding. I recently heard a friend talk to me about the Delano Valley, a place where so much of the food for the world is grown, and yet the Hmong farmers who farm there couldn't open a farmer's market so they could sell their produce to one another.
But, I mean, it's, sadly, I mean, there are these fairly vested interests in the supermarket industry and also in the agriculture industry that are geared towards large-scale industrial agriculture, and sustainable agriculture really doesn't feature on their radar. And I think that will certainly go some way to explaining it. But I agree with you that it's a tragedy. If we look at the way this is playing out in America, it is rural areas, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it weren't rural areas where there are food deserts, where the life expectancy of U.S. citizens is falling now. And it's falling
for the first time in a very long time.
Exactly. And partly that's to do with smoking, but a chunk of it is to do with diet. And the availability or lack of availability of fresh fruits and vegetables certainly feeds into
good
that.
Calories.
Exactly.
Because there is this conundrum of so many people being hungry in this country and many people in the same neighborhoods being completely obese.
Yeah. And this isn't just a U.S. thing, of course. I mean, in India, you're seeing increasing rates of both hunger for the poorest people there, and also India is the country now with the largest concentration of people with type 2 diabetes, for instance. And it's similar dynamics at work, where the very poorest don't get to eat at all, or get to eat very rarely. But if you're an income step up or two from that, then the kinds of things you're induced to consume are not necessarily fresh fruits and vegetables, but the highly processed kinds of foods that are rich in salt and fat and sugar, highly profitable, and the sorts of things that our bodies crave, the sorts of things that make us repeat customers. But sadly, they are the sorts of things that are wreaking havoc on all our metabolisms.
So we've been talking about urban issues, the supermarket being so perfectly paradigmatic of urban life. And we've talked a little bit about rural, but let's talk a little bit about that farmer who is having such a hard time. And one of the things you talk about in the book is the rate of farmer suicides all over the world, which is astounding, when at the same time, farmers are producing more than ever, more people are hungry, and the farmers are dying.
Well, I certainly the toughest part of writing this book was traveling from place to place, talking to families where farmers had despaired. And one story that actually can stand for a few others involves a farmer called Kistaya, let's call him Kistaya, who borrowed money so that he could drill a borehole, a well, so that he could irrigate his land. Because he wanted to leave his acre to his two kids in a better shape than he'd found it. He drilled the hole, the well was dry, and so he borrowed more money again from the moneylender to drill another hole to be able to, because he definitely needed now to be able to increase the productivity, because yeah, he was in debt, plus he wanted to leave something to his kids. And he borrowed again, and the well was dry, and borrowed again, and the well was dry, and in the end he despaired. And one night, after his wife and kids had gone to bed, he filled a glass with water and a pesticide called 4-8, which is it's illegal in the United States, but widely available there. He drank it, and it would have been an agonizing death. He would have paralyzed, he would have asphyxiated, but he can't have convulsed very hard, because he died without waking his wife and two kids. Now, I mean, and the tragedy of it is that that's a story that's happening a great deal in India. There are tens of thousands of farmer suicides every year. But it's not just an Indian story. I mean, small farmers around the world are facing very similar kinds of circumstance, where they've borrowed very heavily to be able to keep a hold on their land. But no one wants to be the first person in their family's history to lose the family land. So they're borrowing to the hilt. And then there'll be just one small thing that happens, a shock, whether it's an injury or a wedding in the family. Or in Australia recently we've seen a drought and that's wiped out farmers, and we've seen suicides there. In Britain, the foot and mouth disease outbreak wiped out entire herds, and again farmers committed suicide there. And of course it all started here in the United States with the farm crisis in the Midwest in the 1980s. And sadly, the sort of epidemic of farmer suicides, I mean, we can see it everywhere. India is one very tragic example where Kistaya, in the end, took his own life to avoid paying a debt of about $350. That kind of tragic story, sadly, is being told in many places right now.
So if we take a look at all of these stories, which sort of seem to illustrate that the people at both ends of the food system are getting a raw deal. The people trying to produce on a not huge agribusiness level, but on an agriculture level, and then those of us who wish to consume and remain healthy. It is almost as if one could look at it as the system that has developed over time now has very strong vested interests in keeping it going the way it is because it yields tremendous profit. So do you feel that the desire for wealth and corporate greed is at the root of a lot of the structural problems right now in the food system?
Well, I do. Unfortunately, I mean, we've just had the Farm Bill passed here. Pretty much anyone who's stopped to consider the matter realizes that the Farm Bill is basically a large check to agribusiness. And agribusiness has both sides of the house, which is why you had this very perverse moment where the president was threatening to veto the bill, well, in fact, did veto the bill, on the grounds that it provided checks for millionaires.
Which is very funny, but that's another conversation.
I think we're allowed to say that on C-SPAN. And at the same time, it was the Democrats that passed this bill. And both sides of the House, I think, are equally culpable here in the perpetuation of pork to large agribusiness. I do think that if you look across the history of agricultural policy, it's always been about greed in one way or another. I mean, colonization in India, for example, was promoted by the Dutch and the British East India companies. There's a very long history of corporate greed bound up with food production and export and trade, bound up with making food available in metropolitan areas, in urban areas, as part of one big system that is, at the end of the day, not about justice or about sustainability, but about profit.
You said two magic words, which we'll talk about when we come back after a break. We'll be right back.
Afterwards and several other C-SPAN programs are available for download as podcasts. Visit booktv.org. More with Raj Patel and Evan Kleiman.
This summer, BookTV is asking, what are you reading? Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano is reading What Hath God Wrought by Daniel Walker. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Mr. Howe examines the time period between the Battle of New Orleans and the end of the Mexican-American War. The Most Famous Man in America, a biography of Henry Ward Beecher by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Debbie Applegate. Henry Ward Beecher, brother of author Harriet Beecher Stowe, was a boisterous 19th-century minister who is credited with being one of the founding fathers of modern-day Christianity. Governor Napolitano is also reading Memo to the President-elect by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman by William Lee Miller, James Madison, A Biography by Ralph Ketchum, The Creation of the American Republic by Gordon S. Wood. She also plans on reading Brokers of Culture, Italian Jesuits in the American West by Gerald McKevitt. And finally, Home, a Memoir of My Early Years by actress Julie Andrews. To see more summer reading lists and other program information, Visit our website at booktv.org.
Afterwards, with Raj Patel and Evan Kleiman, continues.
So I'm Evan Kleiman. I'm back sitting here with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, a really fantastic book on food politics. And I think in this hour, I mean, there's so much to talk about. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, how complicit do you think we in the, quote, first or developed world are in abdicating our culinary skills? This such a fundamental thing, that the teaching of how to prepare food and feed ourselves that's passed from generation to generation has been completely broken.
I think that's right. I think if you look at the amount of time spent preparing meals, it's sort of plummeted from, you know, an hour to 10 minutes now.
Some people, it's probably, you know, a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's as long as it takes to pour the milk on.
Right.
I mean, I think that that's terribly unfortunate, because it divorces us from a connection with life, with sensuousness, with the pleasure of actually making food. But one of the organisations I'm sure you feel the same way, that has really been responsible for reconnecting us is the organisation Slow Food. Now, in their original Italian incarnation, they had a very interesting take on this process of the speeding up of food. That it wasn't anyone's individual fault. I mean, there were some bigger social forces at play that are driving down the amount of time that we have, because our lives are so rushed. We're running from pillar to post to try and, you know, make a buck in order to be able to just, you know, to be able to keep our heads above water. That one of the things that has to go is food. And in fact, I mean, you can see that in the United States, where, by some estimates, 20% of fast food meals in America are eaten in cars. Now, I tell people outside the United States this, and they are shocked, they are appalled, and they wonder, well, is it because Americans love their cars? Is that why? Of course, we realize here that the reason people are forced to eat their meals in cars is not out of any particular fondness for the dashboard, but because people are working. I mean, working Americans are working harder now than they ever have. And at the end of the day, if you're holding down one, possibly two jobs, you're looking after the kids. If you're a working American, you tend to live much further away from the place where you work than if you're middle class. So, you know, long commute times, and the place where you live likely has less green space, less access to fresh fruits and vegetables, as we were saying earlier on. Well, then it shouldn't come as a surprise that the kinds of choices that one gets to make with one's food, if one is in that kind of running from one place to another, is the choice between, you know, Burger King and McDonald's, but that's not a huge, you know, that's not a huge spectrum of choice right now.
No, it isn't.
And one of the ways that Slow Food has kind of taken that on, I mean, in Italy, for example, they understood that for people to enjoy food and have sensuousness through food, to be able to connect with food, you need two things: you need time and you need money. And so their approach to food...
And you need the artisan making the food to stay there and do that.
No, absolutely. And so the solution has been, firstly, that they're encouraging people to pay more for their food, because that way the people who grow and produce the food have a living wage, which is tremendously important. But in order for everyone to be able to afford that food, you need social policy. You need to increase the level of wages, for example. And that's why in Slow Food Italy, there have been very strong moves towards unionism to increase the wages of agricultural workers. And also attempts to create a two-hour lunch break during the working day so people can take the time to enjoy food.
I don't think Americans would know what to do with a two-hour lunch break.
And again...
They go to the gym.
but also, you know, I mean... One of the things that Slow Food is interested in is reclaiming and relearning some of the joys of food. Because you're right, we in this sort of gradual decline in the amount of time we spend cooking and tending to our food, we've lost tastes. Our taste buds have been rather compromised by agribusiness, so that now if it's sweet and it has the right balance of salt in it, we're happy. And I think one of the biggest tragedies that's both cause and consequence of the industrialization of our food is that we are very joyless when we eat our food.
Not about dining or sharing.
No, well, exactly. I mean, food is now a very functional thing, and yeah, I'm certainly not going to cast any stones. I mean, I when I was doing my PhD, I was fueled by Red Bull. And, you know, the odd salad for vitamins, but really not, you know, my diet was very, very bad. And it was only really through researching this book and meeting movements around the world, not just slow food, but an international peasant movement, a landless people's movement called Via Campesina, which has over 150 million members around the world. Talking to them, I learned a lot about how to take food seriously, how to spend the time to be able to savor food. That's a tremendously important skill.
One of the things about this whole argument of pleasure versus fast life, slow life, is it seems very elitist to a lot of people. How do we reconcile this desire to relearn the slow life and reconnect with real food, which I think is starting to actually take hold here in America, with the reality of rural poverty and urban poverty, of people who are so left out of the loop that the desire to enjoy a beautiful cheese slowly is the last thing that they need at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think, again, if we look at the origins of slow food in Italy, I mean, it comes from communism. It was a reaction to communism, a reaction the founders of slow food were socialists, and they were rejecting this sort of austere version of the revolution, where everything would be grey and it would all be sort of boxy and not taste very nice. And in fact, the idea of pleasure is a revolutionary one. It's like Emma Goldman's famous line about, "I don't want to join a revolution if I can't dance." And that's actually a nice way of thinking about the roots of slow food, because the idea of not wanting to join the revolution if you can't dance is that there should be joy, there should be pleasure, there should be fun, and that should be everyone's right as a human being, not the sort of thing that you have to buy your way into, but something that society enables you to pursue. I mean, this is about the pursuit of happiness.
So here we are, we're at this point. What do you see are some roads which can converge to actually make a change, a real change?
Well, I mean, I think that there is desperately a need for social policy.
It comes down to that.
It does. I mean, the reason people go hungry in the world today is because of poverty. So, certainly in the food crisis that we're facing right now, one of the solutions is to just make sure that poor people around the world have an increased purchasing power. That means redistributing from rich, of whom there are a few, but who are spectacularly rich, to the poor, so that they can afford to eat. That's a sort of an emergency step. But things like a living wage, things like limits on the workday, things like healthcare. One of the reasons that Americans work so hard is to be able to get healthcare, which people in Italy, for example, or elsewhere in developed countries take for granted. And I think that's an important element in the sort of bigger social picture. But when it comes to food, there are also things that we can do. We can support sustainable agricultural policy. That means not industrial agriculture, not fossil fuel intensive agriculture, which has got us into a lot of the mess that we're in today. Right?
But don't you think the mess that we're in today, in a way, is like a godsend, because it's revealing real limits to the current structure?
It is revealing limits, but I mean, no one can be happy when now nearly a billion people are hungry.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think, it is unfortunate that it has taken a crisis to point this out. And sadly, there are still policymakers who would pursue essentially the same policies that got us here, sort of trading lots of food over long distances, despite the fact that oil is now prohibitively expensive. wedding ourselves to an industrial agriculture system that requires almost a calorie of fossil fuel to produce every calorie that we eat. By some estimates, more than that. Now, that kind of production system is not sustainable. It's damaging the planet. It's pricing food beyond the means of the world's poorest. And it is a crisis right now. But there are ways out of it, and I think you're right. This crisis is an opportunity to be able to shift to more sustainable agricultural policy.
I mean, it's interesting, like, even as we sit here today, there's a whole new meeting of political policy people around the issue of ethanol and corn, that the rest of the world is coming down hard on the United States and about what it's doing to food prices and how short-sighted it is to trade food for energy.
Right, and of course, the fact that so much of our the food that is grown today is actually about using fossil fuel suggests that actually the trade between fuel and food is goes back much further than ethanol. And it's certainly true that corn-based ethanol is responsible for a spike in the price of certain commodities in the market today. And that's something that in the current crisis is not really being addressed by the United States. Again, the Farm Bill kind of perpetuates this. But ethanol is just one example among many where essentially sort of corporate welfare in the United States and in Europe is pushing forward a very reactionary kind of agricultural agenda, because we have billions spent it for the European Union and the United States to subsidize their farmers. But at the same time, organizations like the World Bank and the World Trade Organization are insisting that developing countries, that poor countries, liberalize their trade. And that means that the poorest farmers on earth are competing against the richest ones. And let's take Haiti as an example. I mean, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. In the 1980s, it was a country that produced the majority of its own rice, but it was forced to liberalize, and this was a World Bank and International Monetary Fund condition, and pushed by the United States government. But now, if you go to Haiti, Haiti grows none of its own rice, and the rice that the people are fighting over in that country come in bags with an American flag on it saying "Gift of the People of the United States." Now that bigger picture, those kinds of trade policies, those kinds of agricultural policies, sadly, have gotten us into this mess, and they do need to be changed.
So this idea of bankers and development. Talk to me a little more about that.
Well, I mean, what we have is certainly, I mean, a sort of technocratic expertise that has taken. I mean, again, let's go back to Haiti. These policies were imposed as a result, ultimately, of economic dogma. The World Bank in the 1970s, for instance, was encouraging countries to increase their tariffs and to create subsidies and to support local agriculture. Well, but that changed overnight with the sort of Reagan and Thatcher revolution, with the rise of certain kinds of neoliberal economic policy. So the bank found itself undoing the things that it had been doing in the 70s. Through the 80s and 90s, it dismantled all of these things. And the bank is, sadly, I mean, it's tremendously unaccountable. It has no connection. I mean, if the bank were a government, it would have long been deposed. But the way the bank works is through conditionality, through saying to a developing country government, look, we can give you a loan, but if you want our money, if you want not to go bankrupt, you'll need this loan, but you'll also need to liberalize your economy. You'll need to do these things that might be a little painful at first. And countries have to, as part of the loan, to cut social welfare, to reduce tariff barriers and what have you. And there's usually popular outcry when this happens. It's a very anti-democratic thing to do. But of course, modern development policy is profoundly anti-democratic. It is about a few experts in Washington or elsewhere deciding what the right course of action is and never being accountable for their actions, and leaving people in developing countries to sort of twist in the wind. And that's why in food riots across the world right now and in history, food riots have always been really about two things, not just about food, but also about a demand that a government be accountable and the government that would listen. And that's what you're hearing in Haiti. I mean, you heard that in the United States, interestingly. There were food riots here in the US in 1919, after the First World War. That happened because, firstly, there was a spike in the price of food after the First World War. But in the front lines of these protests were women. Women who couldn't put the food on the table for their families, but also women who couldn't vote. And so the food riots in the United States in 1917 were riots not only for food, but for democracy. And they were successful. By 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution had been passed and women could vote. And that's what, that's the trajectory that the food riots are taking today. And they are demands for food and democracy. And sadly, institutions like the World Bank are in the business of definitely circumventing democracy. And also, at the end of the day, compromising food security.
So after writing this book, do you find yourself profoundly sad, profoundly angry, or profoundly energized?
I certainly find myself angry. And it's interesting, with a book on food, when you do a reading, they'll usually be like cheese and wine afterwards. And people are usually terrified of what I will think of whatever it is that they have on offer. Because, now what will he think?
Political judgment.
Well, exactly. And I think that impulse is unhelpful, because it's about feeling guilty. And I think if we feel guilty, change won't happen. I mean, throughout human history, progressive change has never happened from people feeling guilty about it. It has happened through people being angry about the injustices that they are exposed to and they cause other people to be exposed to, and going out and doing something about it. So I certainly feel very energized and very angry about the current situation. Not so much guilty, because it's not about an individual deficit of will or anything like that. I mean, the story that I tell is about how what feels like an individual deficit of will is actually shaped by much broader kinds of concern.
So who out there do you think is fighting the good fight?
Well, in developing countries, and even here in the United States, Via Campesina, the international peasant movement I mentioned earlier, is doing fantastic stuff. And
are they linked with Terra Madre from Slow Food?
No, they're not. I believe that there are some discussions going on, but they are. I mean, they've been around for a long time. There are lots of independent, small, democratic, always democratic movements of landless people and peasants. So, in the United States, the National Family Farm Coalition is the U.S. representative, or one of the U.S. representatives. In India, the 20 million strong Karnataka State Farmers Association. In Brazil, the Landless Rural Workers Movement. They've developed this wonderful vision of the way that our food should come to us. It's called food sovereignty. And it has a very long definition, and Wikipedia has it all. it's a vision for the future. It's a vision that demands things like women's rights, which have traditionally not been part of a package.
Because so much food all over the world is grown by women.
Well, yeah, between 60 and 80% of food in developing countries is grown by women. And right now, in the middle of the food crisis, 60% of women are going hungry as opposed to 40% of men. Of the 100% of people who are going hungry, the majority of, by far, are women. So what food sovereignty offers, at the end of the day, is the possibility of a democratic conversation about food. The demand for food sovereignty is a demand to have the possibility of deciding what food policy is going to be. It's like Hannah Arendt's idea, the most important right is the right to have rights. And food sovereignty is saying, well, actually, we need rights to decide how we want our food to be distributed, how we're going to make sure that everyone gets to eat, how to make sure that our food is grown sustainably, that we can connect with it, a wide range of things that connect with food. And I think this democracy point is very, very interesting. It's something that tends to drop out of discussions around food and food policy. And in fact, one of the points I make in the book is that we don't have too much of an experience with democracy. What we have is really its poor cousin. What we know best as democracy is its poor cousin, consumer choice. When we choose, in fact, there's a sort of story about Mountain Dew. Right now, Mountain Dew is producing, has a sort of promotional thing where you, the consumer, get to choose between three kinds of Mountain Dew, one of which will be the Mountain Dew that is selected after the summer. And you can choose between Mountain Dew Supernova and Mountain Dew Voltage and Mountain Dew Revolution. You know, and of course, any similarity between that and the current presidential contest is... Well, actually, it's intentional, because what do they call this? They call this democracy. Now, I mean, it's comic, obviously, at some level.
But this simulacrum of choice lulls the consumer into thinking that they actually are in control of what they're using to grow their children.
Right, exactly. And of course, you know, so much of the choices we make are these sort of bland, banal choices, rather than choosing, you know, the fresh fruits and vegetables, choosing the most sort of local, the seasonal, the food that has, you know, that does respect workers' rights, that does respect the environment. And you know, Via Campesina offer one way of doing that. Obviously, some of the work that Slow Food is doing is very, very exciting in the way that it is dealing very seriously with the issues of fairness as well as sort of the quality of food. Organization near where I live is called People's Grocery, and they're
Brahma Mahdi
and Malika Edwards, I believe, mm-hmm. And they are working on something that Brahm sometimes calls urban agriculture 2.0, which is wonderful, which is about valuing food being grown in urban areas, not just because of the fresh fruits and vegetables that come out of the ground, but also the value that comes from employment in the micro processing of that food, in the distribution of that food to, you know, the local community. There's a sort of a range of multiplier effects that add value to urban agriculture and connecting with food in rural in local areas.
Do you think this idea of localized food sheds is something that could really make a difference in the United States in how food is perceived by agribusiness? If certain cities, like San Francisco right now, is working on this localized food shed idea, we're trying to make sure that as much healthful food that's grown within a 200-mile radius and is given to, that people have access to it, that people who need it have access to that food, that it shouldn't just disappear and get shipped elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I certainly think that those kinds of purchasing policies, these things called food policy councils, which I believe started in Toronto, where, you know, the government, the municipal government usually occupies itself with thinking about how its policies will affect or in some way compromise the availability of food in the community. I think those are tremendously good ideas. I'm not sure how agribusiness thinks about it. I mean, at one level, it's an opportunity to profit if you can source your food and broker that within, you know, within the 250-mile radius. But to some extent, of course, this isn't the sort of thing that agribusiness likes, because, I mean, there is so much resistance within, you know, the industry to labelling the most basic sorts of things.
GMOs.
I mean, GMOs, for example. But also just the provenance of food.
Well, yeah, but how does that happen, for example? That is an example. It's been shown that 90% of consumers in America want their food labeled for GMOs. Yet it does not happen because the political will...
100% of GMO manufacturers give money in large measure to the... to both sides of the house, and it is an entirely political decision, and it is interesting that it's not really been on the table in the United States in the way that it has in Europe, and I think that that's because there is a stronger tradition of sort of consumer rights in Europe than there is in the United States.
Yeah, we tend not to want to rock the boat too much.
Well, and of course it's interesting to think about how that, you know, how GMOs were ushered in the first place. The regulations that were changed by Dan Quayle, he of the grammatically modified potato. Dan Quayle introduced some red tape cutting legislation that meant that genetically modified organisms didn't have to be tested by the Food and Drug Administration. Instead, manufacturers of those organisms would submit a letter to the FDA saying, dear FDA, we have tested these products and we believe that they have they meet your requirements. Thanks very much. You know, lots of love, Monsanto. And that would do, instead of rigorous public science, it was a way of letting the private sector basically run riot. And that's why you see such a large push for GMOs here, is that they've been unchained from the constraints of, you know, sound science and of public interest science and of investigation into the consequences of their crops. Whereas in Europe, there has been some public science, and it hasn't come out in the favour of GM industry at all. So I certainly think that there is a difference in the level of regulation and the inclination of government to regulate in the United States versus Europe.
And an inclination to not be political. We seem to have a harder time standing up for ourselves. And you must feel, after going through all of this research and being so deeply involved, that really the only way that there will be a structural change is through politics.
I think that's absolutely right. But what's heartening also is that more and more people are interested in food, and not just, I mean, certainly in the sort of consumer way of, look, what am I going to eat, and how do I eat better? I mean, that's always been there in a sense. You know, the diet industry is long and multi-$1 billion now. And that concern with individual, with self,
right.
and food and the body, well, that's kind of been there for a while.